Good morning. Welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Today is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for jobs and equal rights for not just African Americans, but all citizens of this great nation. And it also marks the 50th anniversary of that pivotal speech by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I Have a Dream. And so we have a couple of interviews, actually maybe a few interviews today, which will reflect on that particular moment in history. One of the interviews is from the archives, interview with Dr. Theo Harris, whose book, The Rebellious Life, Jean Theo Harris, to be exact, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks, came out a little bit earlier this year on the 100th anniversary of Mrs. Rosa Parks' birth. So if we have time, we'll conclude with that particular interview. And we have an interview with a director, Noah Calloway, whose film, Life, Love, Soul, just came out on the market. Really wonderful film that looks at the epidemic of fatherless households in America. One in three children are living without their dads. And so that's a really great interview. And we also have an interview with Dr. Clarence D. Jones, who was honored last week, August 20th, at the University of San Francisco in its commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington. Really, really wonderful event that featured Mayor Edwin M. Lee and Dr. Joseph E. Marshall, Jr. was the MC. Had lots of folks speaking from the Human Rights, San Francisco Human Rights Commission presented him with honors. And for those that are not familiar with Dr. Clarence B. Jones, he's actually the diversity scholar, visiting professor right now at the University of San Francisco. But he is teaching a course called The Art of Advocacy Speech Writing and another course called From Slavery to Obama. And in August 1963, he assisted Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the drafting of his celebrated I Have a Dream speech delivered at the March on Washington 50 years ago today. And he served as the political advisor, counsel, and draft speechwriter for Dr. King. He's co-author of What Would Martin Say? Behind the Dream, another book, The Making of the Speech That Transformed the Nation, and an e-book which was released last Tuesday, the 20th, Uprising, Understanding Attica, Revolution, and the Incarceration State. He is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post and is writing his autobiography, A Pencil and a Dollar Bill, Memoirs from an African-American Journey, from the Depression to the election of Barack Obama as the President of the United States. He is a former allied member of the New York Stock Exchange, NYSE, becoming the first African-American partner in a Wall Street investment banking firm. In the 60s and 70s, he was twice recognized as Fortune Magazine's Businessman of the Month, founded successful financial, corporate, and media-related ventures, and provided strategic, legal, and financial consulting services to several governments around the world, including the Bahamas, the Dominican Republic, Jamaica, and Zambia. So we're going to play that interview that we had last week also. But we're going to start with a musical selection that I'm looking for. And we're trying to find something with I saw a really wonderful piece on PBS last night looking at sort of the behind-the-scenes organization of the March on Washington. We know Byron Weston was really pivotal there, and James Baldwin. There are quite a few others, and it was a really wonderful documentary that was played and might probably be played again. So you should definitely look for that. So I'm looking for something with Kim Nally. And Kim Nally sings Nina Simone, to be exact. And hopefully I can find that, because I think it would be really apropos if I could find the one. Actually, you know, I'm thinking maybe I should play Renee Marie's Lift Every Voice, and then I'll look for Kim Nally for a little later. So I'm going to play Renee Marie, Lift Every Voice, Star Single Banner, and then we'll shift right into the interview with Mr. Jones, and then after that, the one with Noel Calloway, and again, if we have time, part of the interview with Dr. Bill Harris regarding the rebellious life of Mrs. Joseph Hart.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven. Ring with a harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicings run high as the let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think I came to know your name more specifically when I got the book What Would Martin Say, that you wrote a while back. And when I was in Washington, D.C. this year for the inauguration, you were actually giving a talk, some kind of a round table or something.
At the Smithsonian?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Right, right. And I found out about it. I was there when you were giving it, but I found out about it too late to attend, and I was really disappointed because...
It was standing room only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And I hadn't even known that, you know, you were here, you know, in California, you know, at Stanford, and now you're at USF, which is really, really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just wondering, I know you probably answered this question numerous times.
That's all right. I'll answer it for you, whatever it is.
Okay, sure. Excellent. Yes. And I guess it has to do with, you know, your close relationship with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the crafting of the I Have a Dream speech, which is, you know, the March on Washington is having its 50th anniversary, you know, this week. And you're being honored at the University of San Francisco, you know, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary. So I wonder if you could talk about sort of the, you know,
yeah, well,
what's
let me
going
just step back for a moment.
Yes,
sometimes
please.
There's a shorthand description of saying, I wrote or crafted the I Have a Dream speech. That's not factually correct. That's an overstatement. What I did, in fact, was I wrote textual material for Dr. King to consider using in his speech, which ended up, which he ended up including as the first seven paragraphs of his speech. But I did not write the entire speech. What I did was that I crafted, suggested language that should be, that was incorporated in suggested paragraphs, which really was a reflection of prior conversations that he and I had had about what he should say. It's not as if he went to Washington on the, August 27th and said, oh, my God, what am I going to sit down and talk about? Oh, no, he thought about it quite extensively and had discussions with me and a couple of other of his advisors, and even more importantly, or equally important, on the night before the speech, he met with some of us down in the lobby of the Willard Hotel to get a sharing of views, and what I did was really knowing his work habits and his style, I figured I would provide him in written form a summary of the direction of the speech that we had previously discussed. And not until I actually, not until I was standing some 50 feet behind him, did I know, after listening, that he had in fact incorporated my suggested text as the, well, I didn't find out exactly, to find out exactly which paragraph, but I found out, as I listened carefully, that what ended up being the first seven paragraphs of the speech, he didn't change a sentence, a period, a comma, or a paragraph. He just incorporated it. And then, as was his custom, he added on his own paragraph.
Right.
And then somewhere into this combined written text, his favorite gospel singer shouted to him, tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream, as he was reading from his prepared text. And when he, and I was standing, as I said, 50 feet behind him, and I saw him take the written text, move it to the left side of the lectern, grab the lectern and look out on that vast sea of people. And I spontaneously said to the person standing next to me, whoever that was, I don't remember whether it was a man or a woman. I don't remember whether it was white or black. I just knew that there was another person standing next to me. And I said to them, I said, these people out there, they don't know it, but they're about ready to go to church. Because I could see from his body language, standing to the rear of him, that he's, his whole posture, as he began to speak extemporaneously and spontaneously, was qualitatively different than what he stood when he was reading the prepared text.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, your book, Behind the Dream, The Making of the Speech That Transformed the Nation, in 2011, the audio version of the book is being released today. So
that
congratulations.
Is correct. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So,
what you should do, if I wouldn't mind, you might want to talk to Anne Marie. In your publication, whenever the story appears, you should, at the end, you should, we should include the link to the audio book. It's a USFA link.
Oh, okay.
You know, when you're in the article, you just put it at the end of the article, the link.
Oh, certainly. Oh, that'd be excellent. Yeah. You know, when I was reading your book, What Would Martin Say, a while back, and in the book you talk about how, you know, you came to know Dr. King and, become a part of his legal team. And I had known until, you know, doing some research today, that you actually could be credited with taking, you know, I don't know if it was smuggled out or not, but the
letter from the Birmingham jail.
Yeah, I teach that letter all the time. Like, wow.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, Alpha Zero, the new Alpha Zero American Network,
mm-hmm.
is doing a TV special on that very letter from the Birmingham jail,
uh-huh.
and my role in that, which is going to be broadcast,
mm-hmm.
I guess on so many related to King, on the 27th. I mean, that's going to be the first broadcast.
Okay.
On Al Jazeera Network, it's going to be about the letter from the Birmingham jail on the mm-hmm. 27th of August.
Right. Yeah. That was a really pivotal speech that he wrote.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that speech, and also just about how, you know, Dr. Martin King's, speeches and work, today sort of, you know, when you reflect on 50 years ago, it seemed, I don't know if it went quickly or slowly.
Well, let me just say, first of all,
uh-huh.
the summary characterization and description of the speech is that Dr. King was speaking as the moral compass of our nation, and he was really speaking to and summoning the conscience, the collective conscience of America, to ask rhetorically and to say it in different ways, what kind of nation are we? What kind of nation is the United States that will permit and abide by little black boys and girls having their bodies slammed by high-pressure fire hoses and bitten by police dogs when all they're doing is peacefully demonstrating to end racial segregation? What kind of country is this? What kind of country is this that will have a leader of the NAACP, Ben Gurevich, assassinated on June 12th? You know,
mm-hmm.
that will resist the admission of two students to the University of Alabama, so that President Kennedy had to federalize the National Guard just to get two black students. What kind of country are we? The letter, or I should say, the speech at the August 28th march occurred after several months of growing protests and discontent among the African American community and within the country generally, particularly the young people. Had there been no demonstrations in Birmingham, which triggered some 1,300 demonstrations in 36 states, involving some 300,000 people collectively in different states, there probably would not have been a March on Washington.
Mm.
The March on Washington was an embodiment and an incorporation of the rising protests and thirst and demands of the nation, particularly African Americans, to say, we want this segregation to end now. 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, enough is enough. We want to be free now. We want this nonsense to end.
Mm-hmm.
And as he said in a speech on June 23rd in Detroit, actually, he said the struggle of African Americans today, or he didn't say African Americans, the struggle of Negroes today can be summarized in three simple words: all here and now. We want all of our rights, we want them here, and we want them now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the speech that he gave was a clarion call to the conscience of America to say, look at the contradiction between the way you treat 12% of your population, people of color, and the precepts and principles enshrined in the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. Look at the contradiction between the reality of how 12% of the people are treated and what we proclaim to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you continue to reflect on, you know, the disparities between, you know, people based on race and also economics in your writing. I was noticing some of your pieces, your recent pieces in the Huffington Post.
Right. I'm going to be writing a couple in the next couple of days, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of them on, you know, the one on Trayvon Martin, and then now the new case. Yeah. And in your book, you write about the Jenna Six, and when I was really surprised by that chapter, because I wasn't expecting the analysis that you gave. And I was like, oh, wow, yeah.
Well, I look at, I think, for example, I think that this 50th anniversary
mm-hmm.
poses a challenge, a further challenge to the conscience of America, but I think it poses a special challenge to African-American leadership, because we've come now some 50 years, and we have to start talking and looking at things clinically, empirically, and objectively.
Mm.
Everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own set of facts.
Mm.
And there are some indisputable facts that exist with respect to the African-American community. One of them is the ubiquitous existential presence of violence, gun violence.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other way of saying it. There's no other way of describing it other than what it is. It is the continued use of the gun as a choice for resolving an inevitable dispute that will occur among people. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The disputes, the gun violence among us in the African American community today, is not what I think. It's not other than what the facts are. It is principally black on black violence.
Mm-hmm.
Young black men killing other black men. Okay.
Bye.
So nobody can tell me in 2013 that the gun violence occurring in our African-American community because the white man did it to us. No. There are policies, racist policies that have been enacted that have made conditions in the African-American community, particularly on the question of economic opportunities, more severe than in the general communities. There is a higher rate of unemployment. But, you know, we come from a people who were in slavery. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
We come from a people that had to make a way out of no way. You know, I had to share. Couldn't afford to spend $190 or $200 on a pair of Nike shoes. You know, had to walk to school.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of our heritage. And so I'm the first to come down hard on state and private policies of racism against our community. I'm the first one. Okay, but at the same time, I think 2013 forces us to look inward and say, what sense of collective responsibility does African American leadership have for its communities? And I also have become very, very harsh. And when I hear this constant criticism about how the admitted inequities
mm-hmm.
and the clearly documented instances of racial profiling and overreacting by the police and so forth. But you know, any African-American person who complains about anything today, who is not registered to vote, they have, in my opinion, forfeited their eligibility to open their mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because if you want to make change, you don't make change about talking about it. You make change by qualifying yourself to do something about it. And the way you qualify yourself by doing something about it is registering to vote, and when the opportunity to vote, you go out and vote. I don't care whether it takes you 10 minutes or 10 hours. You vote.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the exercise of political power.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I have two more questions. One, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your work in ending the Attica strike.
Oh, the Attica Freedom? Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, that is like, really?
September 1971?
Yeah.
Here again, I tried to, at the request of Governor Nelson Rockefeller, tried as best I could with others to negotiate a peaceful settlement. Part of the problem is that there was a prison guard that was killed, and it couldn't be clearly evidentially proved who was responsible, in fact, who had killed him. So I knew there was not going to be any amnesty until that issue had been resolved. The prisoners had a series of grievances. All of the grievances were reasonable. And the governor and the commissioner of corrections were prepared to grant those grievances, but they weren't prepared to grant amnesty for the killing of a prison guard. And inside the prison, which was controlled by black Muslim leaders, you had sectarian posturing. You had realistic political leadership, and you had opportunist leadership. There were some members of the people in cell block D who talked about they were going to hold out until they got a plane that was going to take them to Cuba with $10 million in cash. That's a holdout. And then there were other people there who said they weren't going to negotiate a damn thing with Rockefeller and those people, because political power comes from the power, quoting Mao Zedong, political power comes from the barrel of a gun, Mao Zedong, a Chinese leader.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to step in there and deal with that hysterical crisis. And Tom Wicker, Congressman Herman Badillo, State Senator John Dunn and others, the bottom line, we failed. We couldn't peacefully negotiate that. And Governor Rockefeller, who was running for president and did not want to appear to be soft on crime as the governor of the state of New York, he ordered us to stop negotiations. He had us to come out from cell block D and order the prison to be retaken. But I remember the heated political discussions that went on inside cell block D, in which I was trying to talk some political sense to them, saying that we had made some progress in granting of the demands of the prisoners, but that was as far as we could go, and that we might as well try to negotiate a peaceful settlement. And I went to the district attorney of the county where Attica was, and the district attorney said he was not going to indict, have a blanket indictment. He was only going to indict based on individual investigative evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as much as we could get.
Mm-hmm.
And there were certain leaders who refused to accept that. And that's when I said, well, I've done the most I can.
Mm-hmm.
And I was seeking to leave. And some members of the more radical group, they threatened to kill me, called me a sellout. And the black Muslim brothers stood up and said, in effect, listen, invited Brother Jones here as our guest. He came up here unharmed, and he is leaving here unharmed. And if one MF puts a finger on him, that will be the last act he does while he's alive, because I will kill him personally on the spot. That's how bad these brothers were. And then I went on television afterwards, on the David Cross show, because I was so angry with Rockefeller. And when David Cross introduced me, I said, I hadn't even shaved. I was still wearing a smudged suit, dirty shirt. I was angry. But what had happened? 42 people were killed by these state troopers. So the first thing I said in the David Frost show was, Mr. Frost, the governor of the state of New York, no, the hands of the governor of the state of New York are dripping with the blood of 42 people tonight. He turned absolute white. Blanched when I said that. He said, excuse me? I said, in case you didn't hear me, let me repeat what I just said. The hands of the governor of the state of New York are dripping with the blood of 42 inmates in the Attica prison because he did not have to retake that prison by force and gunfire. He had another option. So.
Have you been involved at all in the counter-strikes that are, have been resumed in California around the SHU or the sensory deprivation cells that men, particularly in Pelican Bay, have been?
No, I haven't. I haven't. I've been teaching and I've been writing, but I've been angry. I've been even angry by what's going on in a distant way at the Guantanamo Bay. I saw a picture in a magazine of a chair that is used to force feed prisoners who are on a hunger strike, and the chair looks like an electric chair. They tie these prisoners down, and they force feed them, and they're refusing to eat because they're protesting their conditions. So anyway. Are you going to come this evening?
Oh yes, I'm definitely
okay,
going to come. Certainly, certainly. So the last question or comment is, I wanted you to talk about your autobiography, A Pencil and a Dollar Bill, Memoirs from an African American Journey from the Depression to the Election of Barack Obama. And I wondered, I was reading, and I don't know if it's true or not, that you were raised by foster parents?
My parents were domestic servants. My mother was a maid and a cook. My father was a chauffeur and a gardener. When I was born, 82 years ago.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, January 8th, 1931.
Oh, I can't even tell from your picture.
When I was born, my parents did not have an independent home of their own. The home they had was the place in which they worked. And so before the age of six, my parents put me into 2 to 3 foster homes, foster families, which are families of friends of theirs. So by the time I got the age of six, I guess my mother said, we might have stopped moving this young child around. So they put me in a Catholic boarding school that was run by the Sisters of the Blessed Sacrament for indigent, meaning poor, colored, and foster children. Poor, colored orphans and foster children. Well, I was neither an orphan or a foster child. I had parents. But that's where I was put. And so my parents would come and visit me, and I was there from approximately the age of 6 till I was 13, 14, till I went to public high school. And so when my parents came to visit me, the other boys didn't understand why they would come and visit me and leave me there and not take me home, since they had no parents. So that was a heart-wrenching experience for me. On one side, on the other side, I got the superior education. Classrooms were about 20 to 25, taught by two nuns. Mm-hmm. So when I went to a public high school, I was had been academically educated much better than other students. So I excelled in high school because I was so smart, just that I'd been educated better. Mm-hmm. And that put me on my path. I went to graduate as the president of my high school honor society, mm-hmm. the class speaker for my class. I went on to get a scholarship to Columbia College, academic scholarship, Columbia University. Mm-hmm. Went into the United States military, then to law school, and that started me on my journey.
Wow.
The part of the title comes from the fact that when I was visiting my mother, who was working in a kitchen washing dishes, and I was sitting on a chair one day, and I got up to go and get I was about 10 years old, maybe 10 or 11 years old, and I got up to get a dish towel to help her by drying the dishes. Mm-hmm. She snatched the towel out of my hand and said, "Go sit down in that chair, boy." She said, "The only thing I ever want to see you lift is a pencil and a dollar bill."
Oh, wow.
I'll never forget that.
Oh, that's so nice. Wow.
"The only thing I ever want to see you lift is a pencil and a dollar bill." So that says it all.
Right. Yeah. Oh, wow. So are you almost finished with your memoir?
No, I'm not. I'm very far behind, but we'll finish it.
Oh, good.
By the end of the year, I think.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow. Well, congratulations on your award this evening.
And, thank you so
yeah,
much.
Yeah, I look forward to meeting you
in
a few hours.
Okay.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank you so much, ma'am. Thank
oh, you're
you.
Welcome.
Okay.
Good. Bye-bye.
Well, that was my interview with wonderful interview with Dr. Clarence B. Jones, and it was a wonderful evening last week on August 20th. The University of San Francisco, in collaboration with the Mayor's Office of San Francisco, commemoration of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which is today, wanted to make a couple of announcements. One, with regard to the hunger strike here in California at the at Pelican Bay and other prisons as well. They're about currently, as prisoners mark the 51st day of their hunger strike yesterday, August 27th. Lawyers and advocates continue to express outrage at the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation, CDCR's, attack on prisoners' peaceful protests. After being internationally lambasted in the media last week for threatening prisoners with forced feeding as well as ignoring their medical wishes, the CDCR continues to punish strikers by moving as many as 50 prisoners from Pelican Bay to other prisons. The CDCR issued a confusing press release on Monday evening claiming it had met the demands of the strikers while also maintaining it did not recognize the legitimacy of their protests nor would it negotiate with them. Attempts by the strikers' mediation team to keep open dialogue with the strikers and prison officials have been rebuffed by CDCR. And there was a protest rally yesterday at the Capitol. Yesterday was the 27th. And I'm looking to get someone from the mediation team on the air, perhaps Friday, to talk about what's going on presently with the strikers, as well as negotiations with CDCR and the mayor and the governor's office. Lawyers and advocates have just learned that in an attempt to break prisoners' hunger strike, prison officials abruptly awakened more than 50 long-term Pelican Bay hunger strikers between 4 and 5 a.m. last Friday morning and moved them to various prisons around the state. Ann Wills, attorney for the strikers, responded to this news by saying, Just think of the state of these men psychologically, physically, and medically. The CDCR chose to arbitrarily move these men, many of whom may have already been on the verge of cardiac arrest, making them get out of bed, chaining them up by the legs, waist and wrists, performing invasive cavity checks, making them march to a van, and then taking them wherever. And then isolating the four representatives who remain in the standalone administrative building at Pelican Bay. These people are starving for a cause bigger than themselves. They have been very clear that they are fighting so that new prisoners, particularly younger men and women, do not have to suffer what they have to suffer, said Azadia Zarabi, spokesperson for the Prison Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. Instead of going to meet with the prisoners at Pelican Bay, CDCR is governing by fiat, responding in a public statement to prisoners' demands rather than negotiating with them as human beings. The public should be disturbed by this, to say the least. Last week, as the CDCR was likely planning its early morning raid, strike mediators attempted to meet with both the department and with strike representatives as a way of exploring options for resolving the crisis. The CDCR refused both attempts. Regular dialogue was a common practice during the 2011 strike that led to some moderately constructive discussions between strikers and the CDCR. Marilyn McMahon of the strike mediation team said, "Why would the CDCR foreclose on these completely reasonable options? They can either be open to change or continue to cause suffering. They can't do both. Governor Brown and the CDCR are playing with people's lives to make a point that they are in control," said Donna Wilmot of the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition. "They are using their emergency motion for force feeding as justification to move against the strikers without restraint. Against all human decency, they have used every means at their disposal to destroy this peaceful protest, character assassination, coercion, isolation, and intimidation, and yet the strikers have not been broken." And today marks day 52 of the hunger strike. Despite CDCR's apparent attempt to close the issue with its muddled press release Monday, mediators and lawyers continue to try open negotiations between the department and the prisoners. Supporters continue to urgently request the California Legislature's Public Safety Committee, which convened the meeting in 2011, to convene another special session. Seeking to the strength and resolve of prisoners still on strike, family members and mediator Dolores Canales said yesterday, "I am filled with absolute awe at the strength and character of these individuals who have endured decades-long isolation, and I think it must be hope that fills them with such determination, hope for long overdue change, hope within a system that has kept them in isolation for decades. And I think of great changes in history that only took place when people did not give up and when the awakening of a moral consciousness was stirred within the heart and soul of the public." So that was from Freedom Archive, and you can check their website for other memorandums about what's going on with regards to the hunger strike. Visit freedomarchives.org. And the phone number at Freedom Archives is area code 415-863-9977, 415-863-9977. And you can definitely get in touch with the governor's office, the governor's office, and let them know how you feel about what's going on with regards to this hunger strike. I want to let you know about a couple of other events that are happening today at the Oakland Museum of California. There is a performance, Everyday People, the Unsung Heroes and Heroines Who Powered the Civil Rights Movement, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And that's tonight, or this evening, at 6 p.m., 1000 Oak Street in Oakland. And at the First Congregational Church of Oakland, on Sunday, September 15th, from 5 to 7:30, there is a program 50 years later commemorating the Birmingham bombing. A Northeastern University School of Law, Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project featuring Angela Davis and Professor Margaret Burnham in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Birmingham bombing, is going to take place. And that's $25 admission, and it benefits the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project. And you can visit northeastern.edu/civil rights. And another a book that just came out on City Lights imprint is I Must Resist by Bayard Rustin, and that's published on the centennial of his birth in anticipation of the 50th anniversary of the historic March on Washington. And here is Bayard Rustin's life told in his own words. And Bayard Rustin, a friend to Dr. King, was a pivotal force in the organizing of the March on Washington, which is having its 50th anniversary today. At the University of San Francisco, where Dr. Clarence B. Jones was honored last Tuesday, they commemorate the March on Washington. It's called Dreaming On, Third Annual Critical Diversity Fall Forum. And that's going to take place at the McLaurin Complex at USF, 2130 Fulton Street in San Francisco. And that's going to be Friday, September 27th from 1 to 4:30 p.m. And today, meeting at City Hall in commemoration of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, the San Francisco Human Rights Commission is having a special meeting announcing the winners of the Human Rights Commission's 2013 Hero Awards, and that's today at 5:30 p.m. at 1 Dr. Carlton B. Goodlett Place in San Francisco. And for those that live here in the San Francisco Bay Area, the Bay Bridge has been closed until, I believe, Labor Day, when it's going to reopen, the new bridge is going to be open. So be aware of that and perhaps take BART, because travel across the bridge, the Bay Bridge, is closed, so you have to use other means of transportation. And my last announcement, where is it? There was something else I wanted to let you know about that's happening at the University of San Francisco in September, and I'm looking for a note, and I'm not seeing it. So I'll let you know about that a little bit later. So I'm going to play, before we launch into the interview with Noelle Calloway, director of the wonderful film, Life, Love, and Soul, I'm going to play the song, Nina Simone's song, with Kim Nally singing it. I wish I knew how it felt to be free. I think that's the title. And then we might close the program with something to chat about. We'll see. Yeah, I wish I knew how it would feel to be free is the title of the song. And it's a Nina Simone song. Really wonderful. And then we're going to just go right into the interview with Noelle.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Well, I wish that I knew how it would feel to be free. Well, I wish that I could break all of the chains that are holding me. Well, I wish that I could say all of the things that I should say. I'd say them aloud. could he? How
Kim Nally sings Nina Simone. That's a wonderful, wonderful song. Today on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, we speak to director Noel Calloway, whose film Life, Love, Soul is a pause in the narrative that is America today. If one in three children are living in homes without their fathers, then what does that say about our collective sense of family and the role men play in the lives of their children? When we look at men like Martin King and at his family, the sacrifice they made for the nation and world, when their father was absent from home too many times to count before he was killed, how many important engagements did he miss? How many goodnight kisses were imagined in phone calls home? In Life, Love, Soul, Calloway's character, Roosevelt, raised by a single mom, doesn't know his father and perhaps thinks he doesn't need to know him when the two lives collide in a catastrophe when his mother and younger sibling are killed and he has to spend his senior year in high school with dad. Don't expect a cliche here. The director's story, which plays quite close to home, is anything but what one expects. It is perhaps this unexpected tale that keeps one engaged, then delighted enough to want to see it again. I think I watched it a total of 5 to 6 times. A graduate of Clark Atlantic University, the native New Yorker, Calloway's first feature sets a high bar in story and cast with many box office headliners like Carrie J. Vaughn, Jamie Hector, Chad Coleman, and new actors like Valerie Simpson and lead actor Robbie Tate Brickell. We open with the interview. With the interview with Clarence B. Jones' counsel to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And it's amazing, thinking about Mr. Jones's early life and director Noel Calloway's early life. And actually, there are some places where the two lives are quite similar, and yet see how great these two men are. So, here's the interview with director Noel Calloway, which was pre-recorded yesterday, and he was at the park with his daughter, and she was playing with her friend. So it was a great interview. Here we are.
Yeah, and it's really wonderful that, we be talking about life, love, and soul on the eve of the anniversary of Martin King's I Have a Dream speech. And in a lot of ways, your characters are living their dreams.
Yep, and I mean, the film, to me, is just really representative of the dream.
Mm-hmm.
It's overcoming obstacles, it's believing in your principles, it's sticking to your goals, and that's what the movie is. So
mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, your film, tackles, and I didn't realize that there were so many families without a father in the house or children whose fathers are not playing a role in their lives. One in three children, the statistics read that Lisa sent me. I'm like, wow, that's really a high number.
That's insane, isn't it?
Mm.
Those numbers were eye-opening to me. I knew it was a problem, but one in three is insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're a father yourself, right?
Yes, I am, and if you hear noise in the background, that's because I'm in the park with my daughter.
Lovely. Oh, how wonderful. Yeah. So tell us about this film. This is your first film behind the camera, but not your first film. I was reading on your website, NoelCallowayFilms.com, that you've made 11 films, right?
Well, no, I've written 11 scripts. This is the first film that I've made. This is actually the first film. This was actually the first script that I'd written. I tried to produce another one before getting back to this one. Things didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
And, I just kind of went with my heart. And this film has always been, my baby. So
mm-hmm.
It made sense for this one to be the first one that I would make.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it strikes really close to home too, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's not an autobiography, but it's me speaking for, you know, myself as a 17-year-old. I was 17 when I started this script, so the story comes from the place of, you know, of a 17-year-old who didn't have a father,
mm-hmm.
and who had a lot of friends who didn't have fathers in their lives, and cousins and classmates, and so I felt like, you know, our plight sort of needed a voice,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to put that on screen, and that, you know, that was over 15 years ago, and mm-hmm. it's even more timely now, so it's amazing how things work out.
The story is, it's not what one expects when one thinks about a story about a family, or actually a young man, a family, and then a young man who is growing up without his father in his life. And then later on, when we meet the father and the child, the 17-year-old, meets his dad, we find out that the father wasn't physically, like, present, but he was present because he was supporting him financially all this time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, so you think, you know, a lot of times you think, oh, the father's not around because he's a deadbeat dad, right? And he's just out doing whatever. But in this case, this man, he took care of his children.
Yeah, and I think that's what I think is sort of unique about the film, and I think that's what's important about the film, is it gives multiple perspectives to the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have a lot of times where there are deadbeats. There are men who don't want to be in their child's lives. But then there are many times where the man wants to be there. There are a lot of circumstances that's preventing him from being there.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's sometimes where he's supporting them financially but not allowed to play a role.
Mm-hmm.
So this is just one story. This is just one set of circumstances, but hopefully it leads to conversation that just enlightens people a little more on, you know, just all of the perspectives to this issue, and then it'll help us to start to resolve this issue, you know, on a global level, because specifically in this country, this is not just a black problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, you know, 1 in 3 children. That they didn't put a color on that.
Right.
That's 1 in 3 children growing up without their father in their homes and sometimes in their lives, and, you know, we have to start to rectify that.
Mhm. Yeah. So that's really amazing that you wrote this story, you know, in his first incarnation when you were 17, and then your protagonist, he's 17. You know, that's sort of like that age where you're not grown, but you think you are.
Yep.
And
going back and rewriting it, I think that's what kind of stuck with me, because the first script, again, the story was the same,
mm-hmm.
but just in terms of the way the characters interacted with each other and just the execution of it, you know, I was able to approach that from a much more mature standpoint,
mm-hmm.
But still tell the story of that 17-year-old. I think I was better able to tell the story of the father,
mm-hmm.
you know, as I wrote it later.
Right.
So it's definitely it's been fun. It's been an incredibly fun journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a lot of people think so because you got the Urban Film Award, right?
Yeah. I mean, to be awarded, you know, among filmmakers like, you know, Nelson George and
mm-hmm.
Mario Van Peebles had a film in that festival, and that 50 Cent film, All Things Fall Apart, was in that festival, and to be acknowledged as the audience choice for best film in the festival, was mind-blowing for me as a first-time filmmaker.
Mm-hmm, right. And then your film, I believe it's available now, right? It was released on the market, what, today or yesterday?
Yeah, August 27th, Tuesday.
Today
at Walmart.
Okay.
You know, we're in tons of Walmarts across the nation.
Okay.
For people who can't make it out to Walmart, we're on In Demand, on cable when you go to Movies On Demand.
Mm-hmm.
We're there. We're on iTunes. We're on Amazon. So, you know, we as an independent have had the great fortune of getting our film out to the world. And, you know, the only way that we continue to do that is more people go out and buy it and support it,
mm-hmm.
To show that films like this are viable.
Right. Yeah. Oh, certainly. Certainly, they're valuable and important. So, talk a little bit about this wonderful cast. Some, you know, veterans, and some, you know, new folks that, you know, we hope to see more of. So, let's talk first about, you know, the person who plays the protagonist, Roosevelt.
Oh yeah, Robbie Tate Brickell is you know, just an intelligent, you know, well-raised young man, first off.
Mm-hmm.
And then, secondly, an extremely talented actor. He committed to this role. He actually lived with me while we were filming, just so that he can separate himself from his, you know, he was in college at the time. So he didn't want to be engrossed in college stuff and hanging out. He really committed to becoming Roosevelt. And I think that showed on the screen. And, you know, he has a bright future in this business if he wants it, but he's very smart and talented. He could do a lot of other things. So hopefully he's committed to acting, and I think he is.
Yeah, how did you find Robbie Tate? Because he's so brilliant. I mean, you know, again, sort of shattering stereotypes, he's a straight-A student that likes playing basketball.
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, and that was something I wanted to do. I wasn't a straight-A student, but I was a good student, and I also was on a basketball team, and I didn't use drugs, you know, and I was what I feel is more in line with what the typical teenager is, but in our entertainment, the typical teenager is not depicted that way. So I wanted Roosevelt's character to be someone that was quote-unquote cool, but smart. You know, he his girlfriend, so he ends up with a very beautiful, intelligent girlfriend, and he doesn't do that by being the bad guy. He does that by being himself. So I just wanted to kind of put that image on the screen.
Right.
And I met Robbie at a film festival. I'm sorry, at a screening of another film called Blackout, in which he had a very small role. But even in that small role, I saw talent. I saw, you know, passion, that it was this was something that he took seriously. And also I saw an authentic New York teenager. And, you know, me being a New York teenager once upon a time, I don't like it when they put, you know, actors from other places and have them play pseudo New Yorkers. It's one of my pet peeves. So, you know, I just wanted to keep it true and authentic to what the film called for, and he really carried it to me.
And then, you know, the love interest of Roosevelt. Tell us about that actress and her character, because she they share some things. I guess we don't want to give away the story, but you know, she's from Oakland. Her parents aren't together, and she's been living with her father, and now she's in New York finishing up
living
her
with
high school.
Mom.
Living with her mom, and she's kind of fast.
a little bit. Mia Michelle is the actress, and the funny thing about Mia is, I met Mia. She was a model. I met her at a party. She walked up to me and said, "I'm an actress," because someone, this is when we were casting the film, she had heard that I was making a film. I didn't really believe her. I thought it was just some model trying to hit on me. So I didn't pay a lot of attention, but I put a post on Actors Access, and she contacted me like 2 days later, same young lady, and then I said, "We're having an audition in New York," and she didn't live in New York. I told her, "We're having an audition in New York, you know, for the next week." And she flew up that very next morning and came in and had a dynamic audition, and I didn't see another actress for that role. And since then, Mia has gone on to go to medical school, and she's currently in medical school in Antigua. And she's finishing up her residency, if I'm not mistaken. So brilliant, brilliant young lady and super talented actress. And I think that's what made this film great is I feel like we have really intelligent people affiliated with the film. And that allowed them to capture that depth that we needed for the character.
Wow. And then, you know, some folks that we know, like Terry Vaughn, who has Take Wings Foundation here in San Francisco, and she's a fabulous actress. And then Valerie Simpson, of the musical duo Ashford and Simpson. I've never seen her on screen before.
This is her feature film debut. And that's something that I am proud to say that I was the person who gave her first role in a feature film. It's amazing to me that it didn't happen. You know, she's such an icon. She's so talented. I think she did a phenomenal job. But this was her first film. And then in terms of Terry, like you said, she has the foundation, the Take Wings Foundation. She's an incredible actress, but just an incredible woman, an incredible person. And the way, same thing for Chad Coleman and for Jamie Hector. Like, these are people who love the community, who love, you know, doing for people. Mm-hmm. So they did this film for a fraction of what their, you know, their worth financially, mm-hmm. because they believed in the message and they believed in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think actors and actresses sometimes get a bad rap, but, you know, I have a cast full of just wonderful people, and I can't forget Egypt Sherrod, who also did a wonderful job in mm-hmm. one of her first films as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we had a great time, and I was blessed to have such a talented group of veterans, you know, for my first time behind camera, to trust me mm-hmm. and trust my vision. So it was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Chad Coleman, he plays the father, right?
Yes.
Yeah,
and
phenomenal job. And who
plays
his wife?
Tamara Faye, another, and that was one of the hardest roles to cast, because it took an extremely strong actress to play opposite what Chad was bringing to the table,
mm-hmm.
and it took someone that could capture the subtlety of being a stepmother in such a situation where the stepson is grieving the loss of his real mother and reconnecting with his father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for her to be able to balance tolerating her husband, welcoming her new stepson, and being strong when she needed to and being passive when she needed to, there was so much that she brought to that character. And, you know, I think it's understated how well, you know, what a great job she did.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, the father that Chad portrays, he is in so much pain.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
and you can feel it in his characterization. I mean, it's just like in his hands, you know, which he talks about a lot, you know, because of the work he's done, you know, and back-breaking work, dangerous work, painful work, you know,
mm-hmm.
to support his children that don't know him. And and then don't want to know him when he finally, you know, meets his elder child, you know, because of the accident which takes the life of his younger son and their mother, who he must have respected a lot for him to honor her wishes to stay out of his life.
Yeah, and that's mm-hmm. such a catch-22, because you have to have respect for the woman that's raising your children,
mm-hmm.
And in turn, you're building this resentment in your children for you.
Mm-hmm.
So it was such a dynamic character. I don't know that I appreciated all of the layers into it until I started to talk to Chad as we developed that character.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he had a real understanding for what those words were, mm-hmm. and what that character meant to the story, and he took it to another level.
Yeah. And I was just looking at, you know, some of the work that he's known for, The Walking Dead and The Wire, and I noticed you've got a lot of folks from The Wire.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm a fan of the show. I was fortunate enough to meet Jamie
mm-hmm.
at a festival, and he has a foundation in Brooklyn called Moving Mountains, where he mm-hmm. trains young actors and is a mentor to young men.
Mm-hmm.
So we connected on the man-to-man level, and then when I got him the script, he fell in love with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he, you know, reached out to Chad, and then Deidre, one of our producers, she also knew Chad. So there was just so much synergy with the project for me to be able to get these actors that I've admired watching their work.
Yeah.
For them to sign on to my film, it, you know, it's definitely, you know, that dream that we were speaking about. I'm living that dream.
Yeah. So who is the actress that portrayed Roosevelt's mother, and who is the, I don't know if that was her husband or partner, domestic partner, but the male, the man in Terry Vaughn's character's life.
Tammy Roman plays Roosevelt's mother. Tammy Roman from Basketball Wives, and the crazy thing is that we cast her prior to Basketball Wives. That's how long it took this film to get done.
Wow.
So she was just an actress that came in for an audition
mm-hmm.
and did a great job. You know, she was not famous. You know, I didn't know a lot about her. So, you know, things have kind of gone off the rails in a lot of ways. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, those are her choices. I think she did a wonderful job in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Alan West, one of our executive producers, actually plays Robbie's girlfriend's dad. So she, he and Terry, Terry's character in the film, are separated, but they're, you know, raising this daughter together from, you know, both coasts.
Okay.
So it was, again, another chance for me to put the image of a positive man in their child's life in a different way, in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of the message, is that no matter how you have to do it, you have to be an impactful part of your kid's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you live in another state, whether you live in another country,
mm-hmm.
You just have to, you know, you have to just be diligent about being in your kid's lives.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because when Chad's character confronts Roosevelt, Robbie's character, and says, you know, let me tell you the reason why I wasn't in your life, and
mm-hmm.
then the kid throws back, like, well, you know, if you were a man, you wouldn't have went for that.
Yeah, and, you know, and what a blow, because
mm-hmm.
I know part of that character felt that was true,
mm-hmm.
you know, but the other part of that character knows that it's way deeper than that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and who is this 17-year-old to tell me what being a man is,
mm-hmm.
you know, so there are so many layers and dynamics
mm-hmm.
in those discussions and in that dialogue, and that's to me why it's such a dialogue-driven film,
mm-hmm.
is because we don't get to have those conversations in real life too often. These are things that go left unsaid. And this film gives these characters a chance to say it, and hopefully gives voice to some people who are out there who haven't had a chance to say some of those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And then when Valerie Simpson's character, the counselor in the school, you know, she tries to share her story with what's Robbie?
Keena. Keena's the character's name. Mia's the actress.
Yeah, Keena?
Keena, yeah.
Oh, Keena is, okay. Yeah, and she's not, or she appreciates, but she's not really hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like the way the adults are not all powerful in this film.
Yeah,
know, and they make mistakes, and they are self-reflective, and they actually acknowledge that they made mistakes to the kids. So that's
really
a different kind of scenario there, because usually, you know, like, adults are like God, and we don't make
mm-hmm.
mistakes, right?
Yeah, so there's some lesson in that, too, hopefully,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, everyone's flawed. You know, we're just all on this journey, and we're doing our best.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when you do make a mistake and you're accountable to it and you own up to it,
mm-hmm.
It goes a long way to cementing the greater respect that those young people have for you, because they know that you can be trusted. Because when you present yourself as perfect, that's not trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one's going to trust something that's presented as perfect. You know, even if someone presented a perfect deal to me, I'm going to second guess it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but when you know that there's some warts on it, you know, even like with this film, it's not a perfect film, but it's a good film, and it's a film that I think depicts accurately a lot of stories that people are experiencing out there in real life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your characters, these black families are not impoverished. I mean, they're not on welfare.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Don't figure, right?
Yeah. Chad is a hard-working blue-collar worker. I mean, like, you know, he's working hard, but he's working. And they have, you know, when his son comes to live with him, you know, they don't have a whole lot, but they give him a room. You know, it might
mm-hmm.
not be the house that his mother owned. His mother's a single woman. She's an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
She's raising two sons. And, you know, by herself.
Yeah.
Supposedly, but not really. You know, she's the parenting figure in their lives, you know, with support from other friends. But the father is there. We just don't know how much until
mm-hmm.
the story unfolds, which is really wonderful. Talk a little bit about Mr. Roundtree, because the school plays a real important role in this film as well, you know, and I presume that could be like the community supporting the family, supporting the children, and the family in what they're doing, you know, in trying to raise productive citizens who have trouble sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and they never give up on them.
Right.
You know, like, you know, it's symbolic to me that when things go off the rails for Roosevelt, Mr.
Mm-hmm.
Roundtree is still there. He's disappointed, but he's there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he represents, like you said, that community figure, that teacher that cares beyond the book. You know, when you see something in a kid and you just connect with that kid and you stay with that kid throughout the journey.
Mm-hmm.
I had the blessing of having great teachers in my life. One of my teachers from high school went on to stop teaching and go to medical school, and she actually delivered my daughter. You know, like that's the type of connection I have with my teachers, you know, and she had just had her own first son maybe 4 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks prior, and wasn't even on call anymore. But when, you know, my wife went into labor, I called her on the cell phone, and she's married to another one of my teachers, who Mr. Roundtree sort of patterned after.
Mm-hmm.
I called them, and she came to the hospital and delivered my daughter. And I'll never forget that moment. And that's the way they've supported me throughout my life. They,
mm-hmm.
My teachers are at a lot of screenings. You know, they've supported me in everything that I've done. And it means a lot because, again, there was a time where I didn't have a great relationship with my father. It's much improved now,
mm-hmm.
but there was a time when that wasn't the case. My mom passed away when I was a junior in high school. So without this buffer, this additional adult, positive adult support, I don't know where I would be,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I think it's a testament to, you know, to Jamie's character, Mr. Roundtree, that Roosevelt has some of those values that he had he instilled in him in that very short time. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it takes a village, right?
Oh, yeah, certainly, certainly. And this is a really wonderful story that, without saying it takes a village, shows it, which
mm-hmm,
is more important
mm-hmm.
than just mouthing those words.
Yep.
You know, like so many people mouth, you know, particularly politicians. You know, so
yeah.
where are the resources, you know, one thinks and asks? Because
yeah.
because these are public schools, you know. The children
yeah.
are not in private schools.
Yeah. It a lot of times it's lip service, but the people that are out there on the front line doing the work,
mm-hmm.
they often go uncelebrated and unnoticed. You know, they don't get ribbon-cutting ceremonies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're just in there day in and day out, you know, raising these children, because the raising of children, as you know, is not just in the household. So,
right.
you know, it's important to me as a filmmaker to put those type of images on screen
mm-hmm.
As much as I can.
Right, right, yeah. And these teachers, the doctor that delivered your daughter,
yeah.
is that teacher and her husband, are they from the Frederick Douglass Academy?
They're from the Frederick Douglass Academy. I was... you know, I started there in the 7th grade all the way to the 12th grade, and,
okay.
you know, it was a charter school in Harlem, but mm-hmm. they set such a high standard. You know, they did not believe that because we were from tough backgrounds that we couldn't succeed. And
mm-hmm.
I visited South Africa because of Frederick Douglass Academy.
Mm-hmm.
I had a chance to go to Paris. You know, we learned multiple languages. I took, you know, French and Japanese. I took aviation, so just the educational standards that they instilled in me,
mm-hmm.
and then the connection that was made outside of the school.
Mm-hmm.
She's about to hurt herself. Hold on, I'm sorry.
Sure.
It's okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I said, I'm in the park with my daughter. Sorry about that.
No problem.
yeah, so Frederick Douglass Academy, like, we remain connected because, you know, I have friends that, you know, are working in the entertainment business, and we've all come together to support this film. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just a testament to, mm-hmm. you know, to the people that created that school.
Yeah, yeah. So you said you started there in 7th grade, and meanwhile, you said that, you know, in your on your website that your childhood was tumultuous, that both your parents were incarcerated at one time, and you were in the foster care system, and then you already mentioned that your mother passed when you were 16. How did you stay focused? Because you ended up going on to a historic black college in Clark Atlanta University. Yeah, how did you stay focused?
God, first off, you know, I got to, you know, my faith. You know, I feel like, you know, my God gave me that strength
to know that I was not in the worst situation in the world. Even when things were really bad, you know, it could always be worse. And I've always been blessed. So I was thankful for that. And then my sisters, I have two younger sisters that as I was going through these things, they were going through it too. So I had to be the strength. I didn't have the luxury of sulking over things. I had to show them that we were going to be okay. And, you know, by the grace of God, my mom was only incarcerated, and I say only, but she was only incarcerated for about 2 years. So, you know, when my dad was incarcerated for 13 years. So there was only that two-year period where they were both not in our lives. But my mom was able to come back and show me that, you know, even though she had made mistakes, she came back and was a wonderful mother to us. And, you know, that was something that really, you know, stuck with me as well, that no matter what happens at the beginning, you can always bounce back. And I just kind of carry that spirit forward and, you know, try to be an example for not only my younger sisters, but now I have my own daughter. So, you know, I've always felt a greater purpose than just myself. So that's what has always kept me in line and, you know, with achieving these goals.
Yeah, because you talk about, you know, how life-changing your visit to post-apartheid South Africa was when you went to township, you know, that's poor areas of South Africa, you know, where, you know, black folks are still the majority. Why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, some of these indelible moments, because, you know, one thinks about foster care. I mean, maybe you all lucked out and had good foster parents. One doesn't, you know, in America, you know, it sort of varies. I mean, there's no
blanket. No.
Yeah, so why don't you talk a little bit about some of these indelible moments that sort of shaped you, your character?
Well, specifically to the foster care point, my aunt, who was on my father's side, who I didn't really have a relationship with, I didn't really know her, but she took us in. Which is to be commended. My aunt Dana, like she took my sister and myself, and she raised us for that 2 years that my mother wasn't there, so that we would not have to live with strangers or be in a shelter or anything like that. There was a time when we didn't know what was going to happen, but that was only for a very brief period before she stepped up. So I in a lot of ways, I know that that was life saving for me. And then, like you said, that visit to South Africa. Seeing what these kids were going through, kids my age and younger, you know, what they had to go through just to pursue their education, what they had to go through just to get food and water, it put my situation in perspective. I had just lost my mom. My dad was home from prison, but we had not connected. You know, we were not also a good start. But even with that, seeing the things, like these are kids who didn't have running water, who had one pair of pants, who, you know, just were living in the most, you know, heartbreaking conditions, I could not sulk over my issues. I had to realize that, you know, I have to do the most with what I have and not worry about what I don't have. And, you know, that those two things, you know, my Aunt Dana stepping up and that trip to South Africa, you know, are two of the moments that may have really saved my life.
Wow, that is really, really wonderful. This is just a fabulous film. So the title, Life, Love, Soul, tell us a little bit about the title.
The title actually comes from a song. When I write, I listen to music. And oftentimes it's just like a random selection of music that I don't even know half of the song. But there was one song that just resonated with me, and in the song, the band sings, the song is called Children Don't Stop Dancing, and it's basically talking about the role of adults to preserve the innocence of children by giving them life, love, and soul. And that just stuck with me, like, wow. And it's Children Don't Stop Dancing, Believe You Can Fly, you know, and that to me is symbolic of my life and of my lead character's life, and that, you know, just don't stop believing in yourself, and, you know, we can fly in our own way. Like, the fact that I'm from 153rd Street and 8th Avenue in Harlem, and I was able to write, direct, and produce my own feature film that appeared in theaters nationwide and is now available on DVD worldwide, that's me flying. You know, like, that's, I'm, and this is just the start. Like, I'm not done. Like, this is not, you know, a moment where I'm just going to stop and celebrate. Mm-hmm. But it's a benchmark. You know, it's a time to say, you know, to kids from my neighborhood, there's nothing we can't do.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, certainly. Oh, what a lovely song. I'm going to have to definitely listen
yes,
to that
Creed.
Song.
Creed is the band.
Creed. Oh, I've heard of them.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, nice. And, oh, and we didn't mention by name Roosevelt's brother, the character. Who plays his brother? He is really great as well.
Yeah, Jean-Pierre Rice, and he's now 6'5" and towering over me and Robbie. so it's really funny if you see some pictures that we've taken at different events. Like, this guy's huge, and he's about 15 now. Great young actor. If he wants to do it, also a talented athlete. So who knows what he's going to choose to do in this world? But you know, just really talented and really big.
Wow, that's great. That's great. Well, since you went to a historic black college and Martin King, was a Morehouse man, do a shout out to Clark Atlanta and tell us, you know, how you ended up decided to go there to pursue your college course,
yeah.
Your college degree.
Clark Atlanta. I visited a bunch of schools. I visited Syracuse. I visited Vassar College, mm-hmm. Temple University. But it was just something about the spirit at Clark Atlanta University that stuck with me. It was just a sense of pride and ownership that I hadn't seen. Just intelligent young black people from different walks of life. Everybody wasn't from Harlem. You know, there were people from great two-parent homes, and there were people from single-parent homes. There were people from, you know, a lot of money, and there were people that were from no money. So just to see this collection of young black people just all with similar goals to try to, you know, do better and secure our own future, I was in the right place. So I decided that Clark was a school for me, and, you know, I definitely had that Panther pride.
Uh-huh. That's awesome. That's awesome. And so are you working on a new project now that this film is on the market?
Absolutely. I haven't stopped writing throughout this crazy process. And, you know, I have a bunch of scripts that are ready to go. I'm working on a project called Chloe and Janelle that we're developing, hopefully to shoot by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're just working, telling these good sound stories that are entertaining, and, you know, again, I have a bunch of other stuff. I have two shorts that I did that I'll be releasing soon.
Mm-hmm.
You can visit noellecallowayfilms.com for details on everything that's going on.
Okay.
And hopefully I can really carve out my niche in this business and give our black audience another distinct voice. Sometimes we get caught up and we only have one voice at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm grateful to filmmakers like Melvin and Mario Van Peebles, Spike Lee and Tyler Perry and all those who came before me, but it's important that, you know, it's not just one, that it's just a bunch of us telling a bunch of stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly, certainly. And what's your daughter's name? She's been so good.
Oh, yeah, well, she has one of her classmates in the park with her. Her name is Kellen Calloway.
Okay, Kellen.
Yeah. My baby girl. Yeah, she's 5.
Right. Oh, nice. Oh, nice. So last comment I wanted to give you an opportunity to reflect on, because you've already done so in a lot of different ways as we've been conversing, but is there anything you want to state around the 50th anniversary of Martin King's I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington for jobs and, you know, economic charity, you know, for all Americans, particularly African Americans. Is there anything you want to say about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King and his dream is basically a call to arms for us. It's a call for us to be accountable for ourselves and to demand, you know, what is rightfully ours. Like, that was his dream. His dream was for us to have the opportunity to pursue our dream.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think, you know, this being the 50th anniversary of the march, it should wake us all up to reflect on where we are today,
mm-hmm.
how far we've come, you know, and how far we still have to go, and what is our own individual role in that. You know, for me, It's making good films. It's being a good father. It's being an active, contributing member of my community. But everybody has their own calling, and everybody has to just remember that the dream is something that you have to live. It's not just something you can talk about. So if we all do our part, then that dream comes true. And if we don't, then it dies. And we have to have that sense of responsibility to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I guess sometimes there are these people in our lives that remind us of, you know, our dreams or our goals and aspirations. And I'm trying to think, Roosevelt's aunt is that person. Because remember she says,
yeah,
I was dreaming and your mother was talking to me. Who plays that character? She's great.
Yeah, Egypt Sherrod. She's
Egypt,
a,
okay.
Yeah, that's Egypt. Yeah, radio host, television host,
mm-hmm,
and just wonderful actress and a great woman, you know, just great woman. She has a daughter of her own, beautiful little girl.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, another example of, you know, a positive, beautiful black woman doing great things that sometimes gets under-noticed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so yeah, that's Egypt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her example, you know, because she reminds Roosevelt of who he is, because sometimes, you know, we can get busy or we can get overwhelmed by certain things, and he gets overwhelmed because of what happens with him and his,
mm-hmm,
his girlfriend, and she reminds him of who he is and of,
yep,
who he's the son of, and that helps him, you know, sort of get straight. You know, but
yeah, you need that.
And I think, you know, when you're talking about, you know, Martin King's dream and our responsibility, you know, 50 years later, you know, to make these things real, that sometimes we have to remind each other of what's,
yep,
what these important things are, so we don't get sort of,
Life will sidetrack you, and
mm-hmm,
you know, sometimes it's difficult, but it's important to take that step back and just, you know, remember what your goal is and remember what that map is, because we start traveling and sometimes we forget to look at the map.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think you know, Egypt's character was that for Roosevelt, and hopefully Life, Love, Soul can be that in a small way, you know, for a lot of people out here.
And I hope that, you know, because I know that the Chad's character, is not just a figment of your creativity. I think he probably exists. So I hope, you know, that fathers like,
mm-hmm,
Chad's character, you know, sort of see how I don't have to write it like that. I can, you know, we can rewrite,
yep,
this particular role, which I think,
absolutely,
is a great opportunity your film also lends to the story, because there are different windows where it doesn't have to go the way it's going in the movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
yep,
which is really great. You know, that open-endedness of your characters is really fabulous as well.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I'm so happy we had this conversation. It's been really, really lovely, and I really look forward to other films of yours and more conversations.
Oh, thank you. And just, you know, I appreciate you supporting it, because, you know, we don't have a big advertising budget, so, mm-hmm, you know, people like yourself who give us the platform to discuss it and who spread the word, that's the way we get a chance to make more films like this. So I appreciate you as well, and I thank you for the time.
Oh, you're welcome. You have a good rest of the day at the park with your baby.
All right. All right. Have a great day. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So that was a conversation with director Noelle Calloway, whose film Life, Love, Soul was just released on the market, so you can pick up a copy at various locations. And I wasn't able to get that song that inspired the title of the film, but I do have Kev Mo, who has a wonderful wonderful song called Someday We'll All Be Free. And then we're going to go right into that interview with Dr. Theo Harris about her book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. And that's going to actually go into the, you have to stay on after the show officially ends, because it's gonna be, the interview is a little bit long. And this is just part one of that interview, which was aired a little bit, I'm trying to think, it was the latter part, earlier this year. It was earlier this year around Rosa Parks' birthday. All righty, so here we are. Her birthday was in February, and she would have been 100. So here's Kev Mo someday we'll all be free.
I've really been looking forward to speaking to you, Dr. Jean Theo Harris, about your latest book, The Rebellious Life of Mrs. Rosa Parks. It's you know, really, really well done, scholarly book that's quite accessible for the lay audience.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, this is a real, I guess, historic year for Rosa Parks. I don't know if your scholarship, if the book came out when it did, was because this is the anniversary of her 100th birthday, February 4th, 2013, and with there's been a new stamp released with her likeness for Black History Month. Sort of, what brought you to this particular book, and I know you talk a lot about it in the introduction, but I was wondering if you could maybe for our audience talk about your reasons for writing this book, in which you outline, like I said, quite a bit in the introduction, but you share with us aspects of this woman that I don't know if you know, it's sort of part of the general parlance when you think about Rosa Parks.
Exactly, exactly. I think, I mean, what brought me to the project was actually her funeral. You may remember she died in 2005, and she became the first woman and second African-American to lie in honor in the Capitol. She had a three-state funeral celebration. Her body was brought from Detroit to Montgomery, then from Montgomery to D.C., and then from D.C. back to Detroit for a massive seven-hour funeral celebration. So on the one hand, it was this incredible, you know, almost unprecedented national honor. And yet at the same time, the kind of fullness of her and kind of who she was sort of got lost, and so much of the commentary just repeated, you know, quiet, 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 humble, soft-spoken, quiet. And so I actually got interested in this project in part as a project to think about the memorialization of the civil rights movement. And so I did a talk on that, kind of reflecting on the funeral, but in a bigger context of looking at the ways that the civil rights movement was kind of being deployed in our contemporary moment. Just to kind of put this in historical context, she dies less than 2 months after the travesty of Hurricane Katrina. And so I think we can't think about why we have a national funeral for Rosa Parks outside of that context and the kind of political utility of the kind of of a state funeral for Rosa Parks at a moment when there was kind of growing outrage about what had happened in New Orleans and about federal inaction in New Orleans. And so a funeral for Rosa Parks becomes a way to put a different set of images out there, a much more positive set of images. So I get interested in this, and I get asked to turn the talk into a chapter for a book, and I both realize how much of a story there is, and also that story had not really been told, that there was not a kind of full-length scholarly biography of her, which astonished me. And it sort of seemed to be in some ways part of what I was talking about in the kind of critique of the funeral, which is that she in some sense had become a children's book heroine, and so we didn't really need a full scholarly biography because she'd been, in some sense, lifted up and relegated to again, a hero for children. And yet her political life was so rich and so long, and there was so much there that it seemed really worthy of that kind of treatment. And so that's really where I began, after the funeral. And I spent about 6 years working on the book.
Oh, a long time.
And all, you know, almost half of the book takes place after the boycott, you know, outside of Montgomery, because Rosa Parks actually spends, you know, more than half of her life in Detroit. They move to Detroit 8 months after the boycott ends, in part because they can't find work. They're still getting constant death threats. So in August of 57, they leave Montgomery, and she will spend the rest of her life in Detroit. And so much of my book actually deals with her political life in Detroit, or, you know, a lot of my book, not.
Right.
And I think that's going to be very surprising to people, because I think when people talk about Rosa Parks in Detroit, it tends to be kind of the last sentence, right? It's the epilogue, as opposed to kind of a hugely important and part of her life, and where she was extremely politically active as well, as in Montgomery, and had been in Montgomery for more than a decade, even before her bus arrest.
Right. Yeah. I really like the way you set the stage for Mrs. Parks, and, you know, by giving us the background of her great grandfather, who was a Garveyite, but because he was really light complexion, he wasn't allowed to be an active participant in that movement, and so, and that also comes up when she meets Mr. Parks, because mm-hmm. he was light complexion, but his hair wasn't straight, so he couldn't pass, mm-hmm. Like his, you know, her grandfather could, and then sort of the whole idea around the violence of enslavement, and she was born at a time where, you know, slavery is not something that one reads about. You know, you see the effects of that,
mm-hmm.
And the residual effects mm-hmm. in the psychology and the spirituality and the mm-hmm. consciousness of your family as well as the society, which hasn't mm-hmm. changed much if you're in the South or even the North for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like the way you sort of contextualize that for us using mm-hmm. Mrs. Park's life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I love the way, considering you tell us in the introduction how she gave part of her effects mm-hmm. to a university, but then when she died, mm-hmm. her work, her, you know, effects, which are, should be, you know, in a museum, you know, in archive, and accessible to the public,
mm-hmm.
it's in... What do you call it when you're having trouble with someone? What someone leaves?
Right. So they. I mean, her. There's been a dispute around her
yeah.
estate.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And all of her effects are actually sitting here in New York. The probate judge gave sort of control of the effects to an auction house here in New York to sell, and then the proceeds would go back to the estate. And the auction house has had it for 5 years, and it hasn't sold. It has an exorbitant price tag on it of $8 to $10 million,
mm-hmm.
And it has both her papers, like you mentioned, and then
yeah.
also all of, you know, her dresses, her sewing basket, her medals, her eyeglasses, you know, all of her material effects. And so there are very few institutions that can handle and would want to handle both of those. And so that makes it, I think, also very difficult to sell. And so. So, you know, her papers, you know, many, many of her papers are have not been, and they have not let any scholar see those papers. And I think it's hard to imagine selling the papers of Martin Luther King, of Robert Kennedy, of, you know, of somebody that we thought of as an American political figure, without having a scholar brought in to assess them. And yet no scholar has been brought in to assess
mm-hmm.
Her papers, and I think that's, that's troubling.
Yeah, and it's a real loss.
Yeah, it's a huge loss,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
Yeah, because then you talk about how, as a scholar, you know, not being able to have that primary source,
sure.
You know, how it's, you know, you can't really authenticate, you know, her voice because you don't have all the material,
mm-hmm.
so someone else can write another book.
Sure.
And fill in where you weren't able to extrapolate because you just didn't have the data.
Absolutely. And I mean, I am hoping, even separate from her papers being opened, that my book will prompt more books, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have, you know, we have dozens of books on King. We have hundreds of books on Lincoln, right? That these are, so again, I think, or certainly my hope is that this will just begin to inspire more work on her, you know, in the ways that, again, we do for, you know, lots of very important political figures.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Where I stopped in your book
mm-hmm.
is the chapter that talked about the cost
mm-hmm.
To one's life for one's activism, and you
sure.
title that chapter "It's Fine to Be a Heroine, but the Price is High." And not just to Mrs. Parks, but to her mother and to her husband and to anyone associated with them, but particularly to them, and not just,
mm-hmm.
you know, the economic cost, the physical and emotional cost. It's like amazing.
Right.
But it's not, you know, it's not amazing because there's a war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was going on in the South, you know, Jim Crow was a war. It was a
mm-hmm.
domestic war.
Mm-hmm. And she very much talks about it like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
That it's like going through war.
Yeah.
I think we haven't. I think one of the other problems with the, you know, what I term the fable of Rosa Parks is if it's about one day, then we miss kind of what happens to her afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what happens to her afterwards, like happened to many other, you know, civil rights activists who step into the light, right, is that, right, their economic situation is imperiled. I mean, she loses her job a month in, her husband does.
Mm-hmm.
They never find steady work again in Montgomery. And even after they move to Detroit, steady work is hard to come by. And, you know, so it's really a decade. And then there's both of them have, you know, significant health problems related to
mm-hmm.
kind of the stress of the arrest and the boycott year. She develops ulcers, very painful ulcers that land her in the hospital
mm-hmm.
in 1960. So, but I think we've kind of missed that part of it in the ways that we sometimes see her as this kind of accidental or, you know, kind of it's about that one day on the bus.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, when you juxtapose Rosa Parks and Fannie Lou Hamer, because
mm-hmm.
you know we know the story of how she was
mm-hmm.
first. She was she exercised her right to vote, and then she was kicked off the plantation where she was living and working, and then she was beaten.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, brutally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, oh my God! And
right.
which led to an early death for her because she never recovered from those injuries
mm-hmm.
completely.
Mm-hmm.
So when you juxtapose her with Fannie Lou Hamer, I'm like, yeah, like wow. And then you talk about how she even had some heart trouble connected to that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think we. There has been less attention on kind of the economic retaliation
mm-hmm.
And the kind of effects of that economic retaliation. And again, this happens to many, many civil rights activists. And I think we have talked about the physical violence some, but sometimes miss the other part of that, right? That there are different ways that you could, and that sort of segregationists retaliate against people who stepped out. And some of that was physical, but there were other means that were also very devastating.
Mhm. Yeah. And then it's really the way you tell the story of the resistance movement
mm-hmm.
and the anti-segregation movement
mm-hmm.
as opposed to integration movement.
Yes.
And that's centered on Rosa Parks, not on Martin King.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quite refreshing way to look at that period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think very much for Parks and many of her colleagues, this is about desegregation. It's
mm-hmm.
not integration in that way of just like that. It's not just about a seat next to a white person.
Mm-hmm.
And she's very explicit about that, and also about reminding us that that. In many ways, there was integration in the South, right? If you were a black woman working for a white family and you took those white kids on the bus,
mm-hmm.
you could sit in the front, right?
Mm-hmm.
And as Rosa Parks puts it, that this is it's for the convenience of white people, right? And if you rode that bus, you know, later in the day without those kids, then you had to sit in the back, right? But that that even thinking about the space of the bus, right, that it's a space that accommodates white needs,
mm-hmm.
right? And if those needs are that a black person who is working needs to be in the front, then they get to be in the front.
Mm-hmm.
And so yes, this was a movement for desegregation. It was a movement, I think we sometimes forget that it was a movement for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Right, one of the demands from the outset was for black bus drivers. There was no black bus drivers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a much more robust movement, I think, than we sometimes realize.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out of right a group of people who have been fighting for many years. So Parks and Edie Nixon and
mm-hmm.
Joanne Robinson and. You know, there are many people in Montgomery who began much earlier than, you know, December 1st, 1955.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And I found it really interesting that the pastor of Dexter
mm-hmm.
Avenue Baptist Church.
Right,
Brian Jones. They didn't like him because he was too radical. And that speech that you just excerpt about how you can kill a black person, what was that?
Yeah.
That was
a very...
Wow.
I know. He was a very feisty,
mm-hmm.
And then minister,
mm-hmm.
Dexter Avenue decides they don't want such a feisty minister. They also he's a bit too unpolished, I guess,
mm-hmm.
we could say,
mm-hmm.
for the taste. Dexter Avenue Baptist Church had a largely middle class congregation.
Gosh.
Vernon Johns, he liked having spirituals in the worship. He sold produce after
mm-hmm.
after church. These were things that didn't sit well with his middle class congregation. But he regularly kind of rebuked them for their complacency, and so they right they seek another a less political minister, and they get the Reverend Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
And then obviously, in some sense, he is different from Vernon Johns, and then in another very profound sense, he is not, right? And so
right. Mm-hmm.
that politics really does continue on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Could you talk about in the book about how and Rosa Parks substantiates what you're saying about how activism, you know, standing up for one's rights, resisting, particularly in the place where she was, Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
It was so isolated, there was no support. Like when she was arrested
mm-hmm.
for not getting up and giving up her seat, because she had in prior altercations with bus drivers, she'd just get off the bus.
Right.
And she had noticed, you're right, and that's why she got on the bus of this driver
mm-hmm.
who she had run-ins with before, but
right.
she would avoid his bus. But she didn't, because she didn't notice him until it was too late and she was
right.
on the bus
right.
in this sort of neutral zone where,
right.
It was the first row that would have to be vacated if one white person wanted to sit. That means
right.
that four black people would have to get up and move.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
she said no one got up. She said it would have been, well, you're right,
right.
that it would have been, you know, I mean, she thought later on that it would have been great if everyone in the bus would have got off with her.
Yes, or if somebody, even somebody,
or just one person, yeah.
Said, you know,
mm-hmm.
and she's kind of referencing there this experience. You know, part of this comes out of experiences that she had with her mother.
Mm-hmm.
So at one point she's with her mother, and her mother gets asked to move, and it looks like the bus driver's maybe going to hurt her mother. And
right.
the young Rosa Parks thinks to herself, she's going to defend her mother with her hands. And then a man in the back says, if you put your hands on her, I will,
mm-hmm.
you know, basically do something. And her mother is not, the driver does not, nobody touches her mother. So I think she's also in that moment thinking about this experience she'd had with her mother, where somebody on the bus did say, don't touch that woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think wishing that somebody had done that, and then also understanding why people didn't, both, right? That
mm-hmm.
it's scary, it's the potential for violence is huge.
Yeah.
You know, the ways that, you know, people are just trying to get home from work, right? As,
mm-hmm.
you know, but
yeah.
yes, very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in one interview she talks about it being one of the worst days of her life. Although one of my favorite quotes of hers is she talks about her arrest being annoying
mm.
and irritating. And I think to me that's really a reminder that she does not at all think that this is the beginning of a, you know, a kind of glorious new chapter, right? She sees this as this kind of detour, right, that she's gotten herself arrested because, you know, clearly this is a line that was too, you know, she sort of says, pushed as far as I can be pushed, right? She was not going to get up. But she doesn't see this as, like, the beginning of a movement. She just saw this as a necessary action she had to take. And so I think when she describes her arrest as annoying, I think what she is feeling in part perhaps is that here she is, she's planning this big youth workshop for the weekend. These are the political things she's thinking about, and then now she's kind of gotten herself arrested, and then this is a whole big hassle, right? And so I think it's really a reminder that both she'd done these things before and nothing had necessarily happened. And also that, like, you don't know that moment when history kind of changes, right? And so in that moment, she's sort of thinking about all her other political work and then, like, being annoyed with, like, now she's, here she is in jail.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, because she was saying in her mind, you were saying that she was thinking of all the work that she had to do
mm-hmm.
around, you know, and,
right.
and there she is in jail, and this poor woman was in jail with her
yeah.
and had been
yeah.
there for 2 months.
Yeah.
Her family didn't even know where she was.
Right.
I'm like, wow, so the whole phone call thing was not sort of a given.
And that once you, you know, and that this woman, so Rosa Parks was in jail with a woman who'd had an altercation with a boyfriend who
mm-hmm.
was being violent with her, and she had then threatened him back, picked up a, I believe it's a, you know, some sort of knife or something against
mm-hmm.
him.
Right.
And she doesn't want to, you know, she doesn't want to get back with him, and then so she's basically, like, there in jail and has no way to, is not being, you know, she doesn't have resources and hasn't been able to contact her family. And so I think it does speak to sort of the political Rosa Parks in that moment, which is that she basically says, okay, I will take, you know, your brother's phone number and call them
mm-hmm.
when I get out. And then it all kind of happens too fast, and they come and get Rosa Parks too quickly. And so the woman literally throws the piece of paper kind of down the stairs, kind of in front of the jail where they're being kept, and then Rosa Parks kind of picks it up. But
mm-hmm.
so I think it kind of speaks to her political awareness that even in that moment, that was, of course, also a very terrifying moment, that she's thinking about kind of, right, the politics of imprisonment, the politics of, you know, kind of other people who are there. And then she talks about calling the brother the next day, and that she then sees the woman later, and she's out. And so it's one of my favorite stories, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And going back to what we were talking about, sort of the politics of space and you know, who controls the space and what happens in the space, you know, back to the space in the bus and the space in the prison cell and the space within your community or within your house. And I just think about Rosa Parks, the character navigating these various spaces and how you bring in these different theories, you know, to sort of discuss, you know, what she's thinking and what she's feeling in these different environments.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking, I want to mention a few of them and then you could talk in more detail about them. But, you know, when you write about how the philosophical space of the bus is sort of a microcosm of the larger society, and the
mm-hmm.
bus driver, I didn't even know the bus drivers were armed. Like,
mm-hmm.
when did they stop arming, you know, transit
right.
workers? Like, whoa. And how, you know, to not get up, you know, when the bus driver told you to move, you know, that took a lot of guts, because, you know, you had set that up so well. You talk about, you know, one woman or man after another,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting shot, getting beat,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, the child of a person getting raped,
mm-hmm.
and then there's no recourse, you know, within the law to address this. I mean, people getting shot dead. I mean, one man, you know, he was the veteran, and he was just happy, and he got in the way of the bus, and he was beaten to death almost, and then he died from the wounds.
Mm-hmm,
I'm like, whoa, and no one was ever charged. So that was, you know, that you know, your whole spending that much time just sort of explaining to us and sort of setting that up for us is quite, you know, moving and captivating in the book. And then talking about sort of the navigating the space of the political space, you know, when the young Rosa McCauley meets her husband, and he's working on, you know, the case for the Scottsboro boys, and it's like, wow, they take them dinner. That is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then sort of looking at the NAACP and then finding places to meet, and then they're meeting at her house, and then they all have their guns, and they put them on the table. I'm like, whoa. So
right.
Armed resistance. So
right.
We got to hold that thought, because it shows up again. that's really provocative. And then sort of looking at, you know, her joining the NAACP after her husband just gets fed up with it because he's burned out, and then she gets burned out, and then she goes to the Highlanders and has this sort of opportunity opportunity to be rejuvenated when she meets Septima Clark and Etta Baker and all these other folks, and she sees a society that she wants to see back home, like for real,
mm-hmm.
not just at this, you know, sort of like camp retreat center.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway.
Right. I mean, I think Highlander. So Highlander is this adult training school,
mm-hmm.
And she goes in August. So about 5 months before she, and it's this. She's really. She talks about being really burned out and tired and bitter and like. You know, and in many ways she goes on the suggestion of Virginia Durr, who's a white civil rights supporter in Montgomery, and Rosa Parks is sewing for her at night, and Durr recommends Rosa Parks. They're doing a workshop that August on school desegregation, and in the wake of Brown 2, right? Brown 2 was sort of the Supreme Court revisit. When they did Brown 1 or Brown 1954, they put off the implementation part of their decision for a year to hear more testimony, and so then they come back with that, you know, the historic with all deliberate speed, they put the states back in charge. So for people like Rosa Parks, for people like Miles Horton, who runs Highlander, you know, they know what this is going to mean, which is that there is not going to be implementation unless people push it and fight for it. So the workshop she goes to that summer is about developing a plan for implementation and how do people bring it to back to their communities. And she talks, I mean, she talks about Highlander being the first time she felt like she could express her ideas in front of white people without hostility. She talks about how she would love waking up in the morning and smelling breakfast and having white people make it for her, right? So this is, I mean, so both some of the ways that Highlander subverted, you know, the racial customs of the time, but also there's a sort of, she's there with 48 other people who are kind of thinking about what, you know, how to bring implementation of Brown to life, right? And so this is the kind of sense of what's possible, right? The kind of mentorship of Septima Clark, who's running many of the workshops, black school teacher. And so going back is very hard, right? And I think part of what Highlander is also about is the kind of role of the individual in change and in many ways, you know, sort of these ideas of civil disobedience, right, which is one of the ways that Rosa Parks talks about her bus arrest is that to get up would be that she consented to that treatment and she didn't consent, right? And I think that sense that you can... that the individual is powerful in a situation to kind of dissent is I think an idea that she has before she goes to Highlander, but it is certainly reinforced at Highlander
mm-hmm.
that summer. And so it's a very, I think, important time for her. And she has been an activist, I think you mentioned, so she really gets her sort of adult political start with Raymond as a newlywed. He's working on the Scottsboro case when she meets him. They get married in December of 1932, and so she begins to do some of this with him. And this is super secret organizing. A lot of it happens at night. It's clandestine, right? Because this is in some sense this local grassroots movement that's grown up in the wake of the Scottsboro, the nine Scottsboro boys,
mm-hmm.
sort of being very rapidly sentenced, and eight of the nine of them being sentenced to death, and so they're trying to stop this execution. And again, that's where kind of she begins. And then again, in those early days, Raymond's a much more public activist. And then obviously that's going to reverse. And so it's a very interesting partnership,
mm-hmm.
right? But it's certainly at its heart also a kind of shared political commitment. And I think we sometimes miss that as well.
Mm-hmm.
They have, you know, there are guns on the table at Scottsboro. They have a gun in the house during the boycott, right? This is, this kind of organizing is both very, it's dangerous. And there is, as you mentioned, a kind of history of kind of what we might call what she calls self-protection.
Mm-hmm.
It, in the South that Rosa Parks' own grandfather had sat out at night with a shotgun to protect their house from the Klan. So this sort of goes back to her grandfather and where she grew up, and then certainly Raymond echoes that as well. And she's a lifelong believer in self-defense. She always believes in the kind of right of self-defense, even as she is impressed with the power of organized nonviolence. And so she retains that throughout her life.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And I really like, so you're talking about how with the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP that they were focused on legal defense. Mm-hmm. And as the secretary of mm-hmm. that chapter as well as the national mm-hmm. secretary, I mean, she did some serious documentation of mm-hmm. of you know, people being killed, people being mm-hmm. Abused by law enforcement and mm-hmm. also vigilantes like the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing happened, and that's how, you know, she was getting burned out.
Exactly.
And then she said, you know, often how it just was so hard to rally, you know, African-American Montgomeryans around anything, you know, to try to get them to come together on an issue. It was just nearly impossible. So then she founded the youth contingent of the NAACP, and you know, the side thought that, well, this will be the, you know, the place where action can happen, and that was, you know, the girl, is it Claudette
yes.
Colvin? Yeah, she actually came here to San Francisco.
Wonderful.
With her book, and
that's a wonderful book.
Yeah, and it was like, and it's just crazy the way. You know, there was no support for her, you know, outside of, you know, eventually just the Parks, you know, just undermining. I mean, she's 15. She didn't get up. They had to drag her off the bus, and she even knew how to just go limp,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, that's the training, you know,
mm-hmm.
when you're resisting, you know, with your body and not with arms. And, you know, there's just like the community saying, oh, no, we can't, she won't hold up. And then there were other young people that refused to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of the rumors and the propaganda that came up around their persons and their families and
mm-hmm.
just negative. It's like, wow, that is, you know, that's really undermining, you know, the work.